Malcolm Homeline is Executive Vice Chairman of the Conference of Presidents of Major American Jewish Organizations, joins us for the weekly update here at JM in the AM. Mr. Homeline, welcome back to the show.
Thank you. Good to be with you this morning.
Thank you. I remind everybody that the Young Israel of Midwood, the Young Israel of Flatbush, the Young Israel of Avenue J, the Young Israel of Avenue K, the Talmud Torah of Flatbush, and the Kingsway Jewish Center have announced that Mr. Malcolm Homeline will appear and address the community on the topic of the challenges ahead. On Friday night, October the 26th, that is 1 week from tonight, 8:30 p.m. at the Young Israel of Midwood, Avenue L and Ocean Avenue in Brooklyn, New York. You'll have an opportunity to hear Mr. Homeline on the topic of the challenges ahead, and then you'll have a chance, no doubt, to have your questions answered live on the spot. You'll be able to come up with better questions than I do. You have a whole week to prepare, everybody. Next Friday night in the Young Israel of Midwood, Avenue L and Ocean Avenue. I am sure, Mr. Homeline, that you are very much looking forward to it.
I am. I can't guarantee the A's to the Q's, but certainly there will be a chance for them to make their voices heard.
Well, you're exaggerating. Most people think you have an answer for everything.
I'm glad to hear that.
That's your reputation, at least. I'll tell you two fellows who have an answer for everything, the two folks who were in the debate this week, and we'll talk about the debate coming up, but I guess we should start with what I regard the most significant story of the week, certainly for those living in this area, and I want your reaction to it. So we find out that the FBI foils a plot that was supposedly going to be a terror attack in Lower Manhattan. What was your reaction when you heard about this foiled attempt?
Well, I think there are a number of interesting aspects to it, and I think we'll learn much more when the indictment is published. I think you will find that he had other targets as well, not just the Federal Reserve, and they could include targets in our community or other communities. I think it's interesting that the State Department gave him a student visa in the past year, which enabled him to come here. He never studied. He never did anything of the kind. He just conducted his preparations for his jihad, his personal jihad. He wanted to create some sort of a mega attack. And it's a reminder of what we've talked about for so many years. I know people, even after 9/11, passed a month or two later, people start to forget. And while the reminders every year about what happened then, and certainly the people who were most directly impacted, but others as well, but we don't think about the daily terror. And when police are limited, or law enforcement is limited in its ability to take the necessary steps to prevent. If it weren't for the fact that New York has 1,000 police on counterterrorism and sometimes can do investigations even across state lines or in other ways that some people may not always be comfortable with, but in a war against people who want to engage in the acts that this guy did and so many others who have been caught, I think they should rethink it and understand that you need unusual methods sometimes. It doesn't mean to violate people's rights, but it certainly means that you have to give the much more leeway to law enforcement in order to prevent and not to have to afterwards explain why they didn't do it.
Malcolm, the scary part, I mean, there are a lot of scary parts to this, but one of the scary things is that there are many duplicates of this guy. There are a lot more who have their personal jihad, who have been indoctrinated over their entire lifetime, because obviously their lifetime is relatively short so far in the big picture, and they've been inundated with all this anti-West stuff, and they want to go on their own rampage, their own violent jihad. And the question is, and I know that this one was foiled, but the question is how many other hundreds, thousands, tens of thousands, you know, want to come in from around the world and do the same thing?
Are coming in, and the fact that some people talk about it openly, including the Iranians, the person who was responsible, Namira, for the attack, the planned attack against the Saudi ambassador, who recruited somebody from the narco-terrorism network in Mexico, or tried to recruit him, but was foiled as well in his attempt to kill in a Washington restaurant the Saudi ambassador, pleaded guilty this week, but also acknowledged that he was working for factions of the Iranian government. So this is different in that it's not just individuals. This is state-sponsored. And when you have the network with Chavez, with others, North Korea, Pakistan elements, we see it in the Middle East today, across every border. and the threats just increase. And when you talk about them having more and more sophisticated weapons, when Hezbollah can send a drone, no matter how primitive the drone was, it tells you that their abilities are escalating. When you see shoulder-fired missiles being fired, when an anti-aircraft missile is fired in an Israeli helicopter, it's escalating. And for those who question still why we feel so strongly about Iran's nuclear program, think of what it would mean if they could send out a guy like this with some kind of dirty bomb.
Again, not to be too much doom and gloom, but 20 years ago, or certainly close to that, if not 20, you warned us about the proliferation of these student visas, and so many youngsters from around the world who are coming to the United States, and not necessarily as official spies or even state-sanctioned, just, you know, getting used to American society and learning how things work here, and, you know, for the purpose, eventually, of doing some bad things. I hate to open my mouth on this, but why don't we see even more of a network of sabotage behind the scenes from these types of groups?
Well, first of all, because they're not ready to strike in the United States. They know the consequences are great. That doesn't mean that the infrastructure doesn't exist. And if you look at testimony that the FBI, CIA, others have given in Congress, you see that this is a major concern of theirs. When we find Hezbollah as agents crossing the border from Mexico, when three were arrested last month, if you remember, by Mexican authorities and turned over to the U.S., these are not isolated incidents. We know that thousands of people have crossed our border of this time and background. There has to be a much better filtering process, and there has to be greater scrutiny on the border.
All right. Is there a grade? I know the NYPD and FBI in this area, meaning geographic area, usually gets pretty high grades from you. What about nationally?
I don't think we're doing enough nationally. I think that certainly the NYPD and the Joint Task Force and those people are do deserve credit for what they've done. The NYPD is far ahead of anybody else in the country, sometimes ahead of Washington. But I just think that there isn't the kind of follow-up and the kind of... And I know that there is a lot of concern on the part of people about what is politically correct versus protecting people's rights. And I think that there has to be greater clarity on this.
All right. The election is 18 days away. And yesterday we were speaking on the air with Michael Fragan. We were talking about swing states, Ohio. Obviously, there's a Jewish population there. We've mentioned Florida a million times. I think it's incumbent for those of us who are living in areas where our vote, you know, only somewhat counts because you know what direction the certain state is going in. Obviously, New York and New Jersey are among them, unless we have a big surprise. I think it's incumbent on us to let our friends and relatives around the country know, if they are in a swing state, how important their vote is. I was frustrated when I heard of somebody who had some cockamamie reason for voting in New York instead of Florida when they maintain residences in both places. I think it's important for those of us who are more on the sidelines to convince everybody to at least go out there and vote. Those in the swing states.
The first thing is that they vote. The second is they vote where their vote is most effective. But, you know, the numbers are switching all the time. And Florida now seems to be in Romney's column. Ohio goes up and down by 2 points. 18 days is still a long time. Everybody is concerned about making a big mistake.
Right.
The next debate, you know, will not be decisive. I think it'll be also a standoff. Though foreign policy will be much more sensitive. The revelations today that the CIA station chief in Libya within 24 hours had identified it as a terrorist attack and sent that message to Washington is going to reignite the debate over what happened in Benghazi.
Right.
You know, there are many things. We're also going to see the U.S.-Israel joint exercises for 3 weeks starting next week, and it's going to involve 3,000 U.S. troops. This is an austere challenge. And the chairman of the Joint Chiefs is going to Israel. It'll be obviously high profile. Israelis are going to use the Iron Dome and the Arrow, and the U.S. is going to have the Patriots and the Aegis ballistic missile ship and other air defense systems. Most of it will be simulation, but some will be live fire. I mean, there are going to be a lot of things.
Let me go back to the debate for a second. It seems that the... and by the way, if not for Benghazi, if not for that terrible episode, I don't even know if there would have been another foreign policy discussion in this debate. Like, it's amazing how this entire topic ends up being ignored. Here, it happens to have been a political hot button, And it ended up being an argument over semantics, frankly. It didn't even address the real issue of, you know, national and international security.
I think that's true. And because the economy, stupid is the issue, as what President Clinton campaign became the motto of that, people are focused on the domestic theme, but I find more interest in the international issues as people are confused and unsettled about the developments. You know, we have a whole slew of elections coming up, a Palestinian election this weekend, Jordan election now, Israel election. So in the region, a lot of elections and a lot of other changes. And people are looking at this and they don't get a clear sense from anybody about what the stake is and what's really happening.
Wouldn't it be really advantageous to the president, especially in certain swing states, to mention all this cooperation with Israel and talk about this largest intelligence, you know, cooperative?
He does. He speaks about it all the time.
But you would, I would think, at the debate, it would be a bigger issue.
Because you didn't have foreign policy. Wait and see what will happen now. They will all, the candidates will pledge allegiance to the U.S.-Israel relationship. We'll talk about what they did and what the other didn't do, and you will see that issue raised.
It's America's one and only Jewish Moments in the Morning radio program, heard on listeners-sponsored WFMU East Orange, WMFU Mount Hope, around the world on the web, jmnam.org. Reminding everybody that our fall JMNAM fundraising campaign has begun. Go to the top of our homepage, jmnam.org, and please give generously, and I'll try to limit how many times we and how comprehensively we talk about the importance of supporting this show. The Israeli election is shaping up to be very interesting here. So Aryeh Deri, who had resigned from the leadership of Shas 13 years ago, is now back in the picture as the head of the party. Is that significant?
It is significant because the polls show that he gets four more mandates, meaning four more seats than Shas led by Eli Ishai. We don't know that will pan out when it comes ultimately to the election. It seems more and more apparent that BB is the most popular. His numbers have gone up significantly. His approval rating is 45 positive, 45 negative, which is a significant increase. The election itself will be interesting, not so much about the campaign and the outcome. They will, again, focus on domestic issues, as well as the security situation is always an issue, but it'll be primarily about the social conditions, the economy, because people are hurting, prices are up sharply. But Netanyahu, by setting the date, I think, has largely eliminated the possibility that Olmert will lead a center-left coalition. It also doesn't give people that much time to organize. Yair Lapid seems to be doing fairly well. Livni is talking about a comeback. Kadima doesn't break 10 seats, and it'll be interesting to see if they keep Mofaz or they try to make a change. Yahamovich leading Labor. Labor does better, but Barak's Atzmaut party gets nothing. Doesn't make the threshold to get into the Knesset.
Wow.
Now. So very interesting developments, and Lieberman is doing very well. A most interesting thing I saw so far was that poll of the kibbutzim, I think was overall of the kibbutz movement, showed Lieberman winning.
Wow.
Now, here's the guy who's certainly right of center, but he appeals to a broader sector. He could be the key player.
A nationalistic
then
vote?
Then you're going to see the real jockeying, which will be even more than the election, interesting, between the different parties. And I was told just yesterday that by somebody who's really in the know that it could take a month or 2 months before Netanyahu could put together a coalition.
Is there any small party, and I mean really small party, that could have any effect in this election?
Well, it could in term. It depends on the numbers that emerge, but the religious parties, etc., could always be the balance in them having a majority, or I'm sure Netanyahu will go for a supermajority.
And I understand. Explain why it would take so long for him to form a government. Why wouldn't he have identical, you know, a strategy that he had after the last election?
Because everybody's going to negotiate for the things they want, and they will be jockeying to see what, again, depending on the numbers, if an alternative coalition could be formed, let's say, of Labor, Shas, and Lieberman.
Oh, so when we read that they're going to be sending out draft notices to tens of thousands of Haredi youth, it's a moot point because by the time the next election jockeying rolls around in February, they're basically going to eliminate.
It's going to be an issue, and it's still possible that it will happen because the process is underway, and it's a broad, amongst the Israeli public, there's a broad consensus on the issue.
Yeah, but they're going to need those votes, and they're going to need rather those mandates in order to form a supermajority.
Yeah, so it depends. Under Derry, I think you will see more flexibility in a part of Shas.
Really?
And it's an important indication. Well, he has a good relationship with a number of people, including, I think, Lieberman. The Lieberman is also has a good relationship with some of the other people that people don't know. And they say that Yakimovich and Bibi have a better relationship than is portrayed. So, again, Israeli politics are unpredictable.
What's the Netanyahu-Derry relationship?
I don't know, really.
And the smaller parties like Rabbi Amsalem and
yeah, so they become auxiliary to in the formulation
right.
of a coalition. But you see, if they would all be together and you had a super party that really could deliver a very significant number. So Shas was down. Now Shas maybe under Derry will be up. But different people appeal across lines today. It's not the same as it was.
At what rate do Israelis vote now? I mean, I know it used to be 90%, but do they still get 80% of the polls, or the people who come out to vote?
Yeah, I think 80% is probably a likely number. People are not excited about this election. It's not one where you have cut and dry
issues. And if here it's the economy, is it Iran and Israel, or it's the economy there too?
The economy.
That's it. So even with the Iranian
consensus.
In other words, because people base, right, I was just going to say, people generally understand that whatever security measures need to be taken against Iran and the enemies that surround Israel are going to be taken.
And they support Bibi, essentially. And Bibi put the issue off by his speech at the UN, where he said, essentially, late spring, summer, that took the issue off the agenda for the election. Because, you know, if he was talking about a strike,
right,
you know, before or during or immediately after, it's unlikely because it's also the winter months when it's much harder to carry out. But, I mean, the tensions with Iran have not diminished at all, and we've seen this week some really serious developments.
Imagine the summer of 2013 with a second term or new president in the White House, with Bibi possibly, you know, newly elected with a supermajority coalition, and with, according to him at least, the Iranian threat being at its height. It's going to be very interesting.
And a Jordan that could be in much deeper trouble facing an election now. But
and plus Syria, right.
Syria, with a very uncertain future, that moved to create the Shiite crescent in between Morsi and Turkey, the developments that we see in Lebanon with Hezbollah, you know, trying to assert itself, and question of how far they can go. And there are a lot of internal developments that we will talk about, I'm sure, about what's happening between Lebanon and Syria, between the Hezbollah and the Free Syrian armies. But there are so many plates moving. When we see yesterday alone in Tunisia, the violence in southern Tunisia with people killed, in Libya, 6-8 people killed when the militias against the pro-Qaddafi loyalists, when in Turkey you had this collapse of this effort to change the constitution that Erdogan wanted because of the political infighting and the charter, which dates back, I think, to 1980 in Turkey, which he wants to change because he wants to become the president and enshrine his leadership for much longer and make it a presidential system. The announcements of the Palestinian election and all the corruption that's related to it, and the fact that Abbas' standing is terrible, where Hamas now, Haniyeh, is talking about stepping down and turning over his position temporarily, his responsibilities as deputy, because he wants to run as the head of the political bureau of Hamas, and they're still looking to create their caliphate, and Egypt reshaping its relationship with them. I mean, there's so many, I have lists of these things that are happening in a single day.
But what is reshaping the relationship with them? I would think that they have a very good relationship with them at this point, Morsi and Hamas.
Well, first, for one, Morsi turned down the creation of a free trade zone in Gaza, which is a big thing that Haniyeh has been pushing. It may be temporary. On the other hand, and he's also closed down some of the tunnels, but on the other hand, is an interesting story. 50,000 Palestinians have been given Egyptian citizenship if they had an Egyptian mother, that automatically.
Ooh.
35,000 more are getting, and by next year it'll be well over 100,000. Now, anybody, these statistics, this number, got almost no attention anywhere.
Wow.
It's so important. It tells you what the ultimate goal, that they want to extend the Muslim Brotherhood caliphate and control what happens in Hamas, in Hamastan and Gaza. Haniya is looking to reshape the leadership and to try and enshrine their leadership, and the split with Abbas is getting deeper and deeper, so that we're talking about two Palestinian entities regardless. And despite his threat against about doing the UDI, and this week there was a lot of developments about the unilateral declaration, with the U.S. warning him about the consequence. The British read him the Riot Act, told what the consequences, including financial aid, including other things. And he wrote a letter to Obama telling him why he's going to go ahead and why it's justified. And more importantly, and this relates to the two of them fighting over allegiance, and the way you do it is by being most anti-Israel. On his Facebook page, Abbas this week posted, this is his official site, that Israel doesn't accept Israel's right to exist. He attacked the two-state solution. He denied Israel's history, etc., and all of violating every basic tenet, which is never a surprise with him. But most importantly, he said that the withdrawal that he demands of Israel applies to all territories occupied before 67.
Oh, boy.
And now a Swedish ship is on its way to Gaza again. They're not going to Syria, if you notice. They're going to Gaza, where everything can get in that they want, and that the blockade was proven, and by court ruling proven to be related only to security needs. But what happens in the West Bank, where this election, and by the way, I don't think half the people will vote. They distrust him. The Hamas is not contesting the election, so it's a semi-sham, but he had to do it because this is municipal elections. But what happens in Jordan very much affects the West Bank. And Hassan, you remember Crown Prince Hassan, the brother of the king?
Yeah.
Who was very pro-Israel, more pro-Israel and pro-West, certainly. He gave a major speech where he said that he doesn't oppose a two-state solution, but the West Bank is part of Jordan. Remember who used to say that the Jordan...
Tell us how you really feel. Can you go back for a second to the Egyptian citizenship move? This is for people who live in Egypt now or outside of Egypt?
No, Gaza. Gaza, Palestinians, even the West Bank Palestinians. The deputy head of...
And you know what's funny about this? If Israel still controlled Gaza, they would never have made this move.
They would not have made this move. And that one of the leaders of Hamas, Zahar, even disclosed that he too had become an Egyptian national because his mother was Egyptian. So number one tells you their insecurity about what the situation is there. This is a play to reshift the balance, and Morsi has announced that despite his promise to go after the terrorists and asking for more equipment in Syria, in Sinai, etc., announced that he's not going to go after them anymore. Not going after them more. They're stepping up their anti-Israel stuff, and the religious leader, supreme leader of Muslim Brotherhood, Badi, called on Muslims worldwide to defend Jerusalem and said the Jews were spreading and slaughtering Muslims and desecrating the holy sites, you know, the kind of incitement that we had seen in the past. So Morsi is working many fronts, and he is working with Erdogan. And this is what's important because it relates to the fighting along the Turkish-Syrian border, that they want to establish the Sunni line from Turkey through Syria, Iraq, Western Iraq, Jordan, to the Gulf states and Saudi Arabia, which means we're developing more and more of the Sunni-Shiite divide in this, quote, Arab Spring, winter, fall, that could have, obviously, incredible ramifications. At the same time, we see Al-Qaeda growing in Iraq. They carry out 140 attacks a week. And we've seen Al-Qaeda in other places. Also, the center operation has been diminished, but the branches are still all over and in many cases growing.
Where can people see reports about 140 attacks a week? Like, where do we find out this information? It's not in the general media.
DailyAlert.org. DailyAlert.org. Every day they will get all the information, I think, essentially, that they would need to understand and see these facts. The other thing is that that they have to watch some developments that hardly get any coverage. The fact that in Gaza they fired an anti-aircraft missile for the first time, Estrella SA-7 missile, against an Israeli helicopter. These escalations, all of them, are decisions that have to be taken. So it's part competition between various groups who try to escalate and show that they were, you know, that they are the dominant party against the against Israel. But the concerns that we see, the spreading network in Saudi Arabia now, the Iranian broadcasts calling on the people, the Shiites, to demonstrate. They're 10% of the population, but about 2 million, especially in the oil districts. And we're seeing constant demonstrations there against the government, not because they can overthrow it, but they're trying to introduce instability. That's why they also fight in Yemen against and threaten Saudi Arabia from the Yemeni border, because the instability feeds the interests of Iran. And Iran, you know, spreads its terrorist activities, which get not enough coverage, but they're behind everything. They're increasing the enrichment at Fordo, according to the latest reports, and thumbing their nose at everybody. And the Supreme Leader says he's not going to give in to any bullying or accept any agreement, when we hear that there are negotiations going on, and maybe some sort of yet an October surprise of some cooked-up deal.
Wow. Almost the end of October. The EU, the Nobel Peace Prizing EU, there was a report this week that they've widened their economic sanctions against Iran. Is that true or not?
Yes, it is true. These were British-pushed sanctions that intensify a lot of the existing ones against the oil industry, against banking, against others. The sanctions are having more and more of an impact. The real it collapsed, they say, in 6 months. Iran could run out of foreign reserves and their economy could be in total collapse. But as long as the Senate's selling a million and a half barrels for dollars every day, the regime itself doesn't get hurt, and they take care of their own. They don't necessarily pay salaries of the soldiers, but they themselves have enough money to continue their terrorist activities and supporting terrorism and to continue to function, even if at a lower level. I know that Hamas and Hezbollah, Hamas was cut off a long time ago over the Syrian issue, but Hezbollah also is complaining, and that's why they're turning more to narco-terrorism and other kinds of activities to raise funds, which are extremely dangerous activities. Their export of drugs stepped up significantly, and they have this route through South America, from Western Africa to South America. It's called Route 10 because it's on the 10th parallel. By the way, it was one other story. I just want to mention that somebody said before, and why what the media misses. You know that there's a story that the plane that the Turks, the Russian plane that the Turks forced to land on its way to Syria,
yeah,
claimed that there was some sort of equipment. Now they say there were 17 Russian intelligence officials on the plane because they were going to Syria to identify the 300 Chechens, Russians of Chechen origin, who are supposedly fighting in Syria. So you see how all these things have become international. The battle in Syria is an international battle today. More than half the fighters are not Syrians. The involvement of Hezbollah grows every day. They're firing missiles from across the Lebanese border into Syria against free Syrian army elements, and they're expecting an invasion. A lot of the Lebanese are saying that every day there are funerals of Hezbollah fighters who come back, you know, fulfilling their, quote, jihad duty, meaning that they died in Syria.
What would happen to the Chechens who are fighting in Syria if the Russians went and identified them?
They will join their Hezbollah colleagues who met their end in Syria. The Russians are apoplectic about the issue of Chechnya. They've killed tens of thousands of Chechens, and it's part of the reason why they don't want the unrest from Egypt, from Syria, the idea of regime change, because it can spread, and it spreads in the Muslim world. So this is, for them, a really critical issue.
What do you think of this whole issue of whether the White House or State Department is ultimately responsible for consulate security around the world?
Well, the answer is that they're all responsible. You know, the State Department, and I think Hillary Clinton went out, and then knowing the president later on would say, it's not her, the buck stops here, so he takes leadership. And it's sort of a deflection of the fundamental issue, which is, how did it happen? How was it that we didn't have, knowing that there had been warnings about 9/11, and that, as I told you before, the Egyptian papers carried the story 2 days before that the Israeli and U.S. embassies would be subject to attack. Mm-hmm. The I think that there are still a lot of unanswered questions about the preparation. And the question of our relationship, you know, with Libya. Libya provides more of the terrorists that we're fighting in Syria and fighting in other places per capita than any other country. And who we aid, and it does relate to the issue of Syria, that you have many bad guys fighting in Syria. You have a lot of Islamists, and from what I understand, a lot of the most sophisticated and lethal weapons are, in fact, that coming from Saudi Arabia and Qatar, are going to the jihadists, not to the secular groups. And in Aleppo, we've seen heat-seeking, shoulder-fired missiles in the hands of some of the groups, and they're becoming more sophisticated. Hezbollah and others are providing weapons, but if they're coming across the Turkish and Lebanese border, they originate a lot of it in Libya from stuff from Gaddafi, but also from Palestinian elements, extremist elements. And, you know, it just tells you, amongst other things, the nature of the conflict, that that they're getting more and more advanced weaponry, which means it escalates it. The you see divisions even amongst the Alawites now in Syria, who feel that Assad is putting them in an impossible situation. In his home base of Qardaha, where his family is from, there was the arrest of one of the key Alawite activists, and they've been clamping down on them, and that's his key core support. He couldn't last a day without the support of the Alawites. And also you see a split amongst some of the wealthy elements, like in Aleppo, some of the businessmen, because their economy has collapsed, their savings are worthless. The sanctions in Syria are also having a strong impact.
Wow. Reminder, everybody, at the Young Israels of Midwood, Flatbush, Avenue J and Avenue K, and the Talmud Torah of Flatbush and the Kingsway Jewish Center have announced that Malcolm Homeline will be speaking next Friday night, 1 week from tonight, 8:30 p.m. on the topic of the challenges ahead. Boy, Malcolm, that speech could last about 10 hours.
Well, I've only given the introduction today to some of the issues that we're confronting. And, you know, you look at developments in Gaza, which we've hardly touched on, but there's so many things. And with all these elections and the possibility that right after the election we're going to have a move in the UN on this unilateral declaration, he seems to be hell-bent on it. There are talks that reports of some sort of movement with Iran, that they're going to come up with some sort of a sham deal or try to push a sham deal in to relieve some of the pressure and making strong demands for it. I think we have such a panoply of issues, and then you see the ramifications of it. When you have a guy coming to New York wanting to blow up the Federal Trade Building and perhaps other sites, and the unrest that comes with elections, and people's focus is off of issues and goes to political parties. I'm talking about the Israeli election, but also Jordan, et cetera, including the United States.
Oh, yes. The challenge is ahead next Friday night at 8:30 at the Young Israel of Midwood, Avenue L and Ocean Avenue in Brooklyn, New York. Mr. Homeline, have a wonderful Shabbos. We'll speak again next week. Friday morning, JM and the AM at 21 minutes after 8 o'clock.